Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're having the time of our lives here this week. The Orioles in a real situation here with real legitimate baseball. I'm having real legitimate crab cakes. We have an NFL draft this week and the 25th anniversary documentary, No One Listens. Everyone Hears is coming out on Thursday night at 5:08 p.m. Our friends at the Maryland Lottery are sending us out on we're getting after it this week. Best crab cake up in Carroll County. We're going to be in Hampstead at Greenmount Station giving these away for the Orioles game, Orioles and the Angels. We're also going to be at Greenmount Bowl before that. They don't really open until 3 o'clock. I'm going to be there talking about the horse racing industry and about the future of the Preakness and Pimlico, amongst other things. Friday, we'll be at Fadley's from 2 until 5 live. Luke Jones will join us there, and then he's heading off back to the draft in Owings Mills. My press credential is still under review, so I don't know if we'll have a real representative at the Oriole game. Maybe Leonard Raskin will take me for free beer on the deck. But we're going to be at Fadley's from 2 until 5 on Friday with the Pac-Man scratch-offs. Also brought to you by Liberty Pure Solutions, giving us fresh, clean water, as well as our friends at Jiffy Lube MultiCare, keeping our oil clean in the car. The Oakland A's coming to town. I have all of these Oakland people, and I spend time in the Bay Area. I have some fans, some bleeding hearts, some media people, former media people. Thus far, almost everyone I've reached to, I've collected upon. Mike Silver is going to be coming on after the draft to do a little post-wrap. But I have all of these East Bay people. This guy came to me, honestly. He wrote a book on baseball cards, one of my favorite things in the world. I'm still stalking the Louis Aparicio 1960 Leaf card. I'll get that for $8 before it's all over with. But he did a wax pack book on like really emotions and nostalgia and reality check and baseball and the business of baseball and real life beyond bubblegum cards. And we've enjoyed having him on. He is a doctor of something or another out in the Bay Area. He's an author. We'll have him in the authors and book section for having inked the wax pack. And now he's back after it again. Listen, I should have had Luke Jones in here because no one knows more wrestling than him and this side of Kevin Eck, who was my childhood best friend and also featured in the 25th anniversary documentary. But Brad Baluchin joins us now, having written a wrestling book. And I read the liners about the Iron Sheik. And, I interviewed Bob Slaughter back in the day, and I have all of my wrestling pictures here that it's going to be fun to do this. But, Brad, it's always great to have you on. How is the good doctor in the East Bay, and what is going on with the Oakland Athletics, which was the original genesis of the reason I reached to you?
Yeah, good to see you, Nestor. I've held on to hope for so long with the A's, and, you know, I think the last shred of hope is gone. It's a sad, sad, long final season at the Coliseum. But they're out. They're going to Sacramento and then Las Vegas. And I think that it really is just tragic. Three sports teams in the span of what, 8 years, 6 years have left Oakland now with no major league team left. So, it's hard times. You know, I don't know what else to say. Ownership, is it all about the bottom line, and certainly no sense of civic duty there. So
I can reach for my Baltimore Colts belt buckle from my childhood here. And, you know, I had to go through my archives for this 25th anniversary thing I'm doing. And I found a couple of pictures of me as a little boy wearing Colts stuff, more Oriole stuff as a kid, but I had Colts stuff and I wore it. You know, that's a lesson learned here that I learned when I was a young journalist at the newspaper when all this went down, when the Mayflowers pulled our team out of here. And now all these years later, like, our place is the place where we've had a creep for a baseball owner for 30 years whose kid just cashed out at $1.7 million a week they made every week they owned the Orioles over 1,600 weeks and bilked, took everything and gave nothing. The football owner's hiding. At this point, he hasn't really spoken in years, certainly not in Baltimore or to Baltimore media in any way. He ran from me on a veranda, willingly ran from me 3 weeks ago. So, but the baseball new owner coming in, $600 million for him, $600 million for the football team. The football team's building the bigger, better club level and this and that and the downstairs and the glass thing down in the Coliseum in the front. And Oakland can't keep anything. And LA's funded and winds up raping St. Louis and San Diego of two franchises in the NFL. Sports is filthy, right? I mean, the Arizona Coyotes can't figure it out. They'll go take money from the people up in Utah this week. So, and don't get me started on colleges, right? College has been, you're talking about disrupted. My God, at least baseball's still together and the A's can play anywhere. But baseball, they didn't learn nothing from the Montreal Expos mess that destroyed the Orioles, destroyed the television market in this area, and Montreal playing games in San Juan and farting around with them. It was 20 years ago, and they're still doing that. And that's the part that I'm shaking my head saying, if this were a Marriott or a Subway franchise, they would just strip you of the right to be a Major League Baseball partner, Brad.
Yeah, man. I mean, I don't know what else I can add to that. It's just I think everyone in Oakland is just in a state of collective mourning, realizing that I think there's always been that, again, that little bit of hope that, okay, well, maybe the stadium deal is not going to work in Las Vegas, or maybe the efforts to block it through different petitions is going to work, or the legislature. But at this point, I don't really see any reason to hope. And really, the Coliseum is I know it's a crappy stadium, but I still love that place. I still love that
building. I love
building.
It too. And, you know, we talked about this. It smells like Memorial Stadium.
Yeah.
And it looks and feels underneath like you're walking through Memorial Stadium. It is, it's astonishing, and it pulls at my heart in a big, big way every time I'm there.
Yeah. And we'll see what see what happens to the building. You know, I'm really curious who moves in or what sports teams, you know, soccer or whatever goes in there. Cause I was in Philadelphia recently for WrestleMania, and they have their great sports complex, and it's, you know, it's not downtown. It's south of downtown. It's in its own little area right by the freeway. And I was thinking it's very similar to the positioning of Oakland's Coliseum and arena, in that it's not in that downtown location. And just seeing the way that they've built up the Xfinity Live around the stadium in Philadelphia, you see how
it's also on the subway in Philadelphia. Which
yeah,
is,
on the subway, right?
Yeah,
you know, done properly. I mean, Oakland, the Coliseum and the arena are on the BART, on the train. You know, there's ample parking. It's right off the freeway. It's very similar to the Philadelphia setup. It's just and it's always been the most obvious solution is to just redevelop that site, and the A's ownership from the jump never expressed any interest in doing that, even though it made the most logistical sense to just keep that site. And I think their, you know, their attempts to go to these other sites closer to downtown, just there were too many roadblocks. And then they just said, you know, well, we're out of here.
Well, that isn't that the moral of the whole story? Irsay always wanted to move the Colts. He never wanted to look for a solution to keep the team in Baltimore. And in every case, when teams move, it's the will of it. And I think the inertia of when Montreal quit on the Expos, it was because they even threatened to leave. It's almost like in a relationship, your wife threatens to leave you, she's left. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like literally. And I think for the battered fans of the East Bay, and it's always little brother, big brother with the San Francisco teams. And I mean, the 49ers play in the middle of nowhere, right? Like literally,
right.
Like I was out there 2 months ago.
It's like, it might as well be an office park, you know?
I mean, it'd be like the Orioles moving to Reston, Virginia, and still calling themselves the Baltimore Orioles. Like it's that far.
Yeah.
And it, and for the 49ers fans, it's a regional thing. Now that the Raiders have left, the Warriors are the East Bay thing that everybody can't get enough of. They love them so much, they imported them into San Francisco.
Right.
I never felt like the A's were going to get saved in some way. Like I always felt like that was inevitably bad. And the perception of Oakland, much like the perception of Baltimore, shouldn't say that on a week when Detroit's got an NFL draft, like they had perception. I mean, perception becomes reality. But when three teams leave in a decade, to your point, in facilities that I went to multiple Golden State Warriors games. I went to see Pearl Jam there less than 24 months ago, a couple nights. You know, Oakland, I went to baseball games there. I was at the Tejada crotch chop game with when Johnny Damon got carted off. And like, I got held. I held the AFC championship. I held the Lamar Hunt trophy in front of the black hole with David Modell on the dais. So I love that building, but I've never felt like, when I'm there, there's been any inertia, not even with the Raiders, to ever like when the owner's nuts, to ever figure out that like I would go out there one day and there'd be another thing, like that thing down in LA that they built in Inglewood, right? Like that they've sunk billions of dollars into it. I always wonder where that money was going to come from when they allowed the 49ers to sail. They kissed off the Raiders, right? And they've let the A's become like I said, they should rip the Major League Baseball brand off it because it's not really, you know, what they're doing there. It doesn't equate to what the Yankees do or the Dodgers do.
Yes, exactly.
They're playing chess, not checkers. Brad Baluchin's here. WrestleMania, tell me your fascination with all this and tell everybody what you would say about the Wax Pack and how it changed your life. Because I've met you on a couple of occasions here on my show, but you're like, you have like a real gig in the real world. You're like a PhD, like, and you have this same fascination with toys that like me and Luke Jones have with wrestling and baseball cards. And like, you grew up like the rest of us. You were just a little smarter, nerdier.
That's fair. Yeah, I after the wax pack, a lot of people wanted me to do another wax pack, immediately get another pack of cards or do a football pack or something. And I resisted that because I think too many people just do a sequel, a direct sequel, because it's easy, or it's you know, you can, the money is there. But creatively, that wasn't appealing to me. It's like you can't
Why
go to
did you
the
do the wax pack? Take everybody back. It's not everybody knows what the wax pack is, especially if you're listening in the car.
The Wax Pack was a book written about my taking of a 1986 pack of baseball cards that had never been opened, opening it up.
Why 86?
That was the first year that I collected cards. I'm 43 now. This happened in 2015.
74 was my first year, so I got you. Okay.
2015, opened the pack, went on the road, said, I'm gonna, whoever's in this pack, I'm gonna track them down now, and drove over 11,000 miles all over the country to find these guys. And as you can imagine, in a random pack, you get everyone from stars like Carlton Fisk down to Jaime Coconower, who was, you know, probably no one's heard of. And it's really the story of the afterlife of baseball. You know, what do you do with the rest of your life when you can no longer play and you're 35 years old? And it really becomes this story of sort of growing up and relationships and getting into these guys, their family lives and their personal lives, and how hard it was to let go of their fame. And it was a wonderful story. It was very kind of them showing them teaching me things as I went on the road. But again, I didn't feel like doing that again was that creatively interesting. So I decided to come up with a sort of an indirect sequel and turn to another childhood pastime of mine, which was following wrestling back in the 80s. Like so many people, wrestling, you know, in the mid to late 80s, in the WWF, and having all the action
So where did you
figures.
grow up?
I grew up in Rhode Island.
Okay, so you were in a real WWF territory, but you're much younger than I, right? I guess we look
I'm
at this.
43.
Yeah, I'm 55. So like you were not Bob Backlund and Bruno. You were
No.
our Hulk was already the guy.
Yeah, I was definitely the Hulkamania era, the
Okay, so
WWF going national in the mid 80s.
Saturday night main event, Cyndi Lauper. Okay. So a lot of those characters, Lou Albano, came to me in 1976, 77, 78 on the regional, Vince's dad owning and Vince being the announcer and them wrestling at the Civic Center, the Capitol Center, and the Spectrum with Bob Backlund after Bruno Sammartino. So you kind of came out of wrestling, had already sort of jumped the shark and become a thing. Yes.
Wrestling was huge. It was blowing up. And my favorite wrestler was the Iron Sheik, which was a little strange, but maybe not strange once you know that, you know, my favorite baseball player was Don Carmen. So I was never the person that went for the most obvious choice. And I had gotten
What
to
did
know
you
that.
like about the Iron Sheik?
I think as a 5-year-old, it was just that he had that mustache and the pointy boots
He
and
swung those things, those weights. Yeah.
And he was a heel, and I was drawn to the, again, the not following the crowd. So there was something about his look that I just took to. And so later on, when I was in college, I got to know him personally. I basically figured out where he was wrestling and had gotten to know his agent. And one thing led to another. I was able to meet him and spent the whole first day that I met him hanging out with him and kind of telling him all about my fandom, and we ended up becoming friends and keeping in touch. And
Now, he was a
actually,
big Twitter guy in late in his life. He just passed recently, right?
He this is before all that, but he had a renaissance, a resurgence on Twitter with his crazy ranting about different things. But I had plans to, I left my job to work on a biography with him in 2005, and I actually moved to the town he lived in outside of Atlanta and spent a couple months working with him. And it went completely sideways because he was so deep into the addiction. And, the first line of the book is that the Iron Sheik just threatened to kill me because he was that far gone in terms of, just his behavior was so erratic and volatile. So that collaboration, that book never happened back then. And then fast forward 17
Did
years,
you
the last.
write anything in this book in regard to things you would have put in that book at
Oh
that
yeah,
time, or?
the prologue is all about that. It's in 2005. It's all set back then, and it tells you
Why
how I.
his story was interesting then to you? Why a young writer would
Right. And
follow an idol like around, literally, right?
how I met him, why it didn't work out, all of that. And then I fast forward to 2022 after the Wax Pack, and I said, okay, I'm going to go back on the road again and find him again, along with the guys that were on the show when he became the champion. So Sergeant Slaughter and Tito Santana and Tony Atlas, and then Hulk Hogan because he comes the next month and becomes the champion, and Vince McMahon because he's part of, he's the promoter in the whole story. And this book is the story of that road trip to find all these guys now. And in this case, it's really about how much they became their characters, how much they forgot, Hulk, or let's look at, you mentioned Sergeant Slaughter. I mean, he's a guy, his real name is Bob Remus. He's from Eden Prairie, Minnesota. And he really kind of became this character so much so that until very recently, even publicly, he would not admit that he didn't serve in Vietnam.
Kayfabe, right?
Keeping up the kayfabe. Yeah. Even, but years after kayfabe has ended, and it was, I think some of the guys from that era, they just have a really hard time letting go of that protective instinct for protecting the business.
I'll go Mork and Mindy here. Brad Baluchin's here. He is an author and lives out in the Bay Area. I reached in because the athletics you're playing, but the wrestling side of this, and Luke and I did a long segment on wrestling. I'm not disinterested in you. I'm literally just going through all the pictures because I found when I did this documentary, I found all of my childhood pictures. That's Wahoo McDaniel and King Kong Bundy in the ring.
Oh, wow.
There's a very bloodied Ronnie Garvin in the ring at the Baltimore Arena. There's Precious Paul coming in.
So that Baltimore Arena, is that still there?
This is the CFG Bank Arena now, yes, and it's a concert facility primarily at this point. It was built for the Baltimore Clippers and for the Baltimore Bullets before the Bullets moved. It's a 1962 building. So there's Ric Flair. So there's Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man. I always had ringside seats. There's another Ted DiBiase. Let's see what else we got here. This is like a baseball card pack for you, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Larry Zbyszko. There's Larry's, and Larry was always good at pointing, and it always involved the San Martino family. There's Wahoo McDaniel bloodied up in the corner there. Some maybe King Kong Bundy turned on him. There's a Hawk, Animal, and Hawk, the Road Warriors, doing the big tongue thing. This is one of my all-time. I took this picture on a baseball trip in summer '83 with my parents, and I sold our tickets at Busch Stadium and I went to the Kiel Auditorium to see Harley Race and Ric Flair in an
Oh, wow.
NWA championship match. So I get a little pile driver. So like I've got a wrestling on. There's Hulk, there's your guy. There's Hulk in the ring in St. Louis at the Kiel Auditorium. There's the Baron, who I got to get on the show because he does things. Baron von Roschke, who's also a Minnesotan. There's Ric Flair doing his thing. There's Rick in his regalia. This is the late great Terry Funk. We just lost him recently, and I knew I had to picture him. I told Dennis Colla. We have a lot of wrestling fans here, Brad. And this is Hulk Hogan. This gives me a chance to show all these off in '83. And there's Hulk in the ring. Really good picture, Hulk I took. And then the final picture is Harley coming in. Looking like the everyman that Harley Race was, like the 11-time NWA champion that he was. So I'm a wrestling guy. So when I heard WrestleMania and your affinity for all this, it was born out of this weird relationship with the Iron Sheik, huh?
Yeah, I mean that's the backstory. And then I went on the road again a couple of years ago to find him again and reunite with him. And
What'd you find?
he ended up passing away only a few months after I was with him at again at his house in Georgia. And it was crazy. I turned the book in June of 2023 to my editor, and then a few days later, I get a text from his daughter that says, "You know, my dad just passed away last night." And so I scrapped everything, got on. They invited me to the. They had a private service. I flew back out to Atlanta, got to go to his funeral, and the only wrestler actually that showed up was from his era was Sergeant Slaughter, and he gave one of the eulogies, and that was a really nice moment. But yeah, I was, I unexpected that that would happen. And then I ended up writing an epilogue to the book because that was sort of the end of the story.
You know, I doing this crazy doc this week. I have Keith Brewer is my voice of God. He was in the band The Ravens. He did the show 2 weeks ago, and we talked about Behind the Music being the conflict show. He did a show on VH1. He was the voice of God for a show before they were rock stars and to tell these stories. And before they were wrestlers, and then after they were wrestlers. While they're wrestlers, they're on your screen. They're wearing their thing. They're doing their thing. And then you see a movie like The Wrestler that was made years ago. Controversial to some degree, based loosely on a couple of different lives. But Kevin Eck is one of my best friends. He's been an industry guy forever. We grew up together, and we would always ask those questions back in the 80s and 90s. What does George the Animal Steel really do? He's a teacher in Detroit, off,
Right.
and he's just a gigger, like a jobber in the summer that comes in. And where does the high chief, Peter Maivia, go? Oh, he's raising grandkids who become the Rock, like later on in life. And all of these, the ethnic stories that were a part of this, the masked men, the managers, but the drugs. George Zaharian was a name I knew as a child, because his name was announced as part of the, he was the attending doctor at ringside, a doctor, George Zaharian, and I've had Gary Michael Capetta on many. So I'm a wrestling geek, of that era. I lost it all after like Hulk Hogan, and it sort of when guys like you came along, and it was more international and much more racy. Stacy Keibler, by the way, Miss Hancock, excuse me, Wrestling Hall of Famer Stacy Keibler, I gotta get that straight, was my intern here in 1999. I've known Stacy all of her adulthood, and I didn't even put that in the documentary. My wife's like, "You probably should put her in." I'm like, "God, I gotta put her in, right?" But like the wrestling part of all of our lives being in Baltimore. We all have, anybody my age has a wrestling story somewhere along the thing. But I think all of us have come to grips with, after all the deaths, all of the drugs, all of the stories, all of the send-ups of movies, that this is, and just Vince being literally a mafia don, controlling careers, not just a little bit, completely, in an industry that's monopolized. No matter what Alex Marvez tells me when I see him in AEW and Sting a couple of weeks ago, but it's a tough life, right? Like any book about wrestling that's being honest, really tough.
Yeah, and I think that's where this is not a typical wrestling book because it does focus on the humanity of these guys and again about who they are beyond the ring. And really, I mean, my training is as a fact checker in journalism. So I imagine taking on an assignment like professional wrestling, which is entirely based on an illusion and really has no written history. I mean, it's really hard to research wrestling because unlike sports, where you have every single newspaper in the country covered major sports every day, there doesn't exist for wrestling, right? So much of what we may think we know is based on oral history and repetition of stories, and not a lot of academics or a lot of journalists who are outside of wrestling come in and give it that level of scrutiny. So I was really happy to take on that assignment and take on that challenge.
I guess in writing about it and finding these people, these human beings, at what where do you find the other characters in the book and say, I want to talk about the Iron Sheik with you? Which is, what's your entree to track down these folks this time? In the same way that when you were tracking down Rick Sutcliffe, you simply said, I'm a, wacky dude writing this book about cards, and I want to have a little access to spend some time with you. I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist my whole life. I've made that call and said, hey, I'd like to sit down and talk to you. Or, hey, Brad, can you come on my show and talk Oakland A's, and we'll wind up talking wrestling for half an hour. But what was your response to, I think it's different when you're going to Pete Rose, he wants money, right?
Well, so you'd be surprised. I mean, you wouldn't be surprised. So my entree was these guys were all there on the show in Madison Square Garden when the Iron Sheik won the championship. And so I was approaching them and saying, hey, I'm telling the story of how the WWF expanded. I'm telling the story of, who you all are in your real lives, who the Iron Sheik is.
So there's a
And
lot of business in this book, right? Correct? Because it
yeah, like, I
affected
mean,
their
like,
lives,
oh,
right?
and that's where I'm really proud. I broke a lot of new ground because I found, for example, the CFO of the WWF from 1983, who had never been interviewed before, but he was one of the only people that would know things like how did Vince McMahon fund his expansion? How much did the first WrestleMania gross? How much did Hulk Hogan get paid? I mean, like insider kind of details like that that really hadn't been found before or hadn't been disclosed before. But when I approached a lot of these guys, I mean, a couple of them, they did say like, well, I'm not going to talk to you unless you pay me. And I tried to explain, well, that's not how journalism works. And they were like, well, then I'm not going to talk to you. So, for example, Tito Santana, Tony Atlas, for them, I did agree to pay them, but I said, the deal is I'm going to disclose that to the reader. I'm going to be upfront about that. And that was my way of, handling the ethics of that situation.
So wrestling was so important to me. Brad Baluchin's our guest. You can Google him. It's BalukJian, like Kirk Jin.
Well, I tell people now the much easier go to thebradpack.com and that's my site.
Thebradpack.com. Easy
Yeah.
enough. Dude, I'm going to share something with you. So this is a story. So like about 5 years ago, I can tell you exactly when it was because there's a Facebook 3 years ago. So like time flies to 2021. Luke and I do wrestling a couple times a year in WrestleMania, and we talk about the things I saw and share some ticket stubs and stories. And I've just found these pictures, right? And Luke hasn't seen these. The only one that's seen them is you and me and anybody that watches us out on the YouTube thing. But I'm going to share a bunch of this in the 25th anniversary documentary. The Rock is in it. Vince is in it because they've sat on the show. We did a show back during the Raw era where Mick Foley and I mean all of my heroes, Tony Garea,
Right.
Pat Patterson, they were working for the company then. So they
Yeah.
sat down. It wasn't completely kayfabe. You know what I mean? Like this was afternoon sports radio live from the arena. We talked. When Vince came on, we talked about putting on Raw and why Baltimore was a good market for them. So it wasn't like totally in character at all.
Right.
But so I love wrestling enough to love it. But back in the 70s, when I was a little boy, I was in a town called Abbeville, South Carolina, that I went and visited 6 months ago because my mother died. She was born there in 1919. So I have a little bit of you and me, like in this trail of.
Right.
Sammy Hagar was playing in Greenville that night too, which was a big reason to go. But so I wanted to go to my mom's hometown, and my aunt, my favorite aunt, my Aunt Edna, long dead, dead 30 years, took me to the wrestling matches, or she called them wrestling matches. And we went over to Greenwood. We can drive you over to Greenwood. Takes about 15 minutes, but it feels like 100 miles when you're from the south. And she took me to a card in a baseball stadium that the Greenwood Braves played in. And my buddy Chris Pica is a nerd, a research nerd, and just a wonderful human. And he's a newspapers.com guy. And I said to him, can you look and research this newspaper on this day to find the card from the newspaper of the
Yeah.
card I went to? And it's amazing because this is going to come full circle when I show it to you because it involves you now. So the card that night in Greenwood
Wow.
was. Tony Atlas, strongman Tony Atlas
Wow. So
was the.
what year would this be?
This was 1979. I looked it up. It was July 17th, 1979. I wrote a beautiful little passage about my Aunt Edna. But Blackjack Mulligan took on Big John Studd, who did my show in, a million years ago. He lived locally, lived in Maryland. Jimmy Snuka was before the Coconut, before Rowdy Roddy Piper, Paul Orndorff, Swede Hansen, Sergeant Goulet. And at the bottom of the card, a couple guys you've never heard of. But these were guys in the NWA doing a job on a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Tony Atlas was trying to get to the WWE. He was trying to get discovered, right?
Yeah.
And all of these guys, but Tony Atlas, tell me about him because he was at the top of that card that night that I remember all these years later, and I saw him wrestle many times. He was just an incredible physical specimen, right? He was
Yeah, he was a Mr. USA, a great bodybuilder. He actually pinned Hulk Hogan in, I mean, to give you a sense, when Hulk Hogan first got to the WWF in 1979, Tony Atlas was a much bigger star. Tony was, if it wasn't for Tony's demons, he would have probably been maybe a world champion or definitely up there at the highest levels. But like a lot of these guys, I mean, Tony already from childhood was had it rough, right? I mean, he grew up in just abject poverty in Western Virginia. His dad left the family early. I mean, it was so bad that he would defecate in a box under the bed as a kid. They had no toilet, and he ended up in a boys' home around age 11 or 12. When I met with him up in Lewiston, Maine, he told me all about this and how not only was he dealing with all that, but just the overt racism and just horrible, horrible stuff growing up in the 50s and 60s down there, and got stabbed in the back with a pitchfork by a local farmer.
And then he wrestled for me one night in 1979 after doing all of that. He wound up being a guy that I wanted his autograph when I was a 10-year-old boy at ringside, right? Like that's a there's nobody that we talk about Jackson Holiday showing up in the lineup and dad and like oh, and is he ready for it? He's 1 for 30. I mean, these guys are not ready for that level of fame in wrestling, specifically in wrestling.
Well, he told me the stories about how, he was washing dishes and making, like, I forgot how much it was, just peanuts per week. And then all because he had that physique and that look and that presence. And at that point, the way that wrestling was structured in those territories, the promoters, each promotion, they wanted to have like their one black star who was a baby face and their one Latino star who was a baby face. Unfortunately, there wasn't room for more than one. But they saw with Tony's look, they were like, this guy could be our next black babyface star. And so they actually, this is unheard of for that time, but they paid him to train to be a wrestler. That's how much they wanted him. A guy named George Scott, who was a promoter in the Mid-Atlantic territory down there in the Carolinas.
Not the Big Bopper, not to be confused with the 1975 Wax Pack with the Boston Red Sox or the Milwaukee Brewers. I'm just making sure.
And so they trained him down there in Charlotte, North Carolina, the YMCA, and they got him up to speed. And he, before you know it, he was on the fast track. He started wrestling in the mid 70s, so he's already pretty much main eventing like the show you saw in 79. He was already a regional star. And
But a
eventually
star
he
then meant $200 that night. You get in a rental car and drive on to Valdosta that night, right? And drink as much as you can and try to find a girl for the night or, pool hall or like that was the life in
I
1979
would
for these
say
guys,
people
right?
should read that chapter because that it's not, yes, but also they didn't pay for anything. I mean, the people were giving them cars to drive so they could free advertising. I mean, they were mega stars even in those regional territories. And eventually Tony Atlas becomes, he and Rocky Johnson, The Rock's dad, become the WWF tag team champions. I mean, they were way up there, but the drug issues, all of that took Tony down. And I mean, it's great that he's doing well now. He's actually, when I met up with him, he had just gotten back from a wrestling match. So he was still wrestling at 69.
Yeah, it's a tough life. And I would have said that last time we were talking baseball cards, I would have said, you're doing wrestling? Tough life, man. Brad Baluchin joining us here. And next book, I don't know what you are other than a PhD, and I'm still trying to figure you out. I mean, I want to talk some baseball and some Oakland A's with you and seeing if you're up on the Orioles, but I'm not sure what you do. 'Cause tell everybody what you do in the real world as a
Well, I mean,
I told
actually,
my wife you're like a scientist kind of guy.
I'm a scientist. I discovered all these species of insects that live in Tahiti. I teach biology, but I'm actually transitioning now more into doing the writing full time. And so if this book, in order for me to do another pack book or another book, this book has to sell well enough. And book publishing is a tough world these days. So I hope I can. I hope I can do more. I'd love to do more writing. But yeah, I have this very strange, part science, part journalism career that's been very rewarding because I'm just kind of indulging my passions.
I had always hoped that you and I would go to an Oakland Athletics game at the Coliseum. I guess I have one last shot, huh?
We only got about 4 months.
Are you abstaining or are you going? Or are you
Well, I've
if I
actually.
came to the Bay Area and said I'm going to the game, would you go to a game or no?
I mean, I would if I was actually right now. I'm actually in Rhode Island where I grew up, because I'm here to do a book tour for the release of the six pack, and so I'm not even in Oakland right now. Maybe later on in the summer I'll be back out there, but for now I'm East Coast.
Well, I hope you get a lot of press. I hope people talk about this. And last thing for you is, the Vice thing shows up on my, which probably speaks to me, but the Vice thing shows up on my timeline a lot with that
The Dark Side of the
ongoing
Ring.
series. Yeah,
Yeah.
I mean, I'm fascinated. My wife and I sat and watched the Fabulous Moolah one a couple
Oh,
of
yeah.
years ago. Anyone that I, the Bruiser Brody one, I kind of was wanting to watch it, but I didn't. But that is a part, a point of journalism that exists that I haven't seen in any other format. And a lot of these stories, I was going to ask you, has Tony Atlas told this story probably to someone on a podcast or a blog or this or that somewhere along life's highway the last 30 years and trying to promote wrestling and promote himself? But a lot of these stories do feel a little untold.
Yeah, I think I mean, some of that's been out before, but I was able to break a lot of new ground, talking to people like the new Hulk Hogan when he was a kid, or people that hadn't really been interviewed before. So I'm confident that anyone with an interest in this stuff will be satisfied that there's a lot of new stuff that they haven't seen before.
Is Bruno Sammartino's name in the book?
Ooh, yeah, I'm sorry, but he may not have made
I'm just
I mean,
asking. I just
yeah.
need to know.
don't think I
I'm.
don't think Bruno, because he's his time had passed. I mean, certainly Bob Backlund is a part big part of it, but Bruno was just a little bit too
What about
far
Bob
back.
Backlund? I once had a beer with Bob Backlund at the Bills in Highland Town. Bob liked me, and I liked wrestling. And Bob did the show until you couldn't have Bob on anymore. And we talk about CTE and football players and like all of that. Life expectancy for a lot of guys. And Bob Backlund is a guy clearly you.
No, I think, are you there?
Yeah.
I'm
I said
sorry.
Bob Backlund is a guy you did not talk to, right?
Yeah, and for those issues, I was going to do a chapter on him, but from my sources and reporting, I realized he's got some serious health issues, and so he wasn't going to be in a state to be able to do an
Yeah, that's
interview.
an amazing thing because his story, whatever it is, would be fascinating because he was larger than life when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, right? Like, I mean,
Yeah.
like, and when you still believed and before Hawk came along. So it was kind of a weird time for me to be a wrestling fan. We also had a weird thing here, Brad, where in 79, 80, 81, 82, Baltimore was a real contested territory where the NWA and Georgia Championship Wrestling started bringing in Ric Flair because it was such a hot market. And the arena, the Baltimore Civic Center, then that then became the Baltimore Arena and the Royal Farms Arena after that, now the CFG Bank Arena, was a really serious wrestling place where you would get Andre in here 3 times a year on 2 different cards. You would get all the end once. They could sell tickets here and cable television came and they could and Georgia Championship Wrestling came. It really during the 80s, it opened that door for everything you remember, Cyndi Lauper, and where all that was. Baltimore was just a great, it's a mark town. You know what I'm talking about, Brad.
Yeah, well, like you said, it was at the forefront of the war because it was right on the boundary of where the WWF's territory ended. And so like there were the Southern territories wanted to make that incursion into the Northeast, and Baltimore was kind of the gateway there.
How was Hulk Hogan?
Well, the Hulks, have you ever interviewed Hulk Hogan?
I have never interviewed Hulk Hogan. Thank you. I mean, I appreciate that. I have interviewed Ric Flair, Slaughter. Some of the guys, yes. Some of them, no. No to
Well,
him.
neither have I. And that chapter is about my attempt to interview, sort of like Carlton Fisk in the Wax Pack. I went through a lot of trouble to try to find Hulk, Terry Bollea is his real name, down in Port Tampa, Florida. Found his childhood home, knocked on the door, ended up getting a tour, found the people he was in rock bands with before he was a wrestler, went to his karaoke bar and saw him there. He was right, just 30 yards away. But he wouldn't sit with me for an interview, so I wasn't able to, sit down and ask him things, but I was able to still report on his story.
All right. Well, he's had a sordid one as well, especially in regard to journalism and media and free speech in our country. You can
Right.
Google that, doctor. Brad Balucci is here. His book is out. And anything you want to say on the Oakland or the baseball thing? Has baseball escaped you a little bit, or do you watch? Do you know who Gunnar
Yeah.
Henderson is?
I don't I don't keep up with it every day, but I'm also a Phillies fan, so being back here, and it's been a good time for Philadelphia sports. So I'm hoping that they can finally break through, one of these years and go all the way.
They play a
But
central role as the victim in the only good thing that's ever happened in my life in 1983, you know? So
oh, right. There you go. World
I
Series
was a
tied.
Phillies fan during that period of time. So it was kind of heartbreaking for me in sort of a weird way because I love both teams. I mean, the
Well,
Phillies were my National League team, you
that
know?
was the last time the Orioles were in the World Series, right?
Yeah, you can remind us of that. I remind Luke Jones. Luke Jones was born the first week of October of 1983. So every time he goes on a trip, I have to fill out the form with his birthday. And I'm like, oh man, that was the week Tito Landrum hit the bomb and beat the White Sox, and you were just getting born. Like, that's how far behind you are. And it wouldn't be so bad if you were like a Red Sox fan and it sucked for a while and you won a couple of times, or even if you're like a Royals fan, or even if you're a Phillies fan, you've had some fun, dude. Like, you know what it's like. It wasn't just Tug McGraw and nothing. You know, that's what
Tell
we are. We're
me,
Tug McGraw and nothing is what we are here.
in Baltimore, is there any effort now to get a basketball or hockey team?
No.
This is not even a thing.
Well, if it were a thing, Ted Leonsis would be up here trying to get money because our city and our state have given $600 million to the baseball owner. And you talk about Hulk Hogan running from you. Steve Bisciotti and Eric DaCosta ran from me 2 weeks ago. They don't like journalists that much, even the hometown guys. So they're getting all the money for the state. So there's never. I've been on the air 32 years here. There's we don't have the money as a market to support that. And when Ted Leonsis was trying to run the Wizards, who went down there 50 years ago from us, into Northern Virginia, and all that got pushed back into DC, there would have been an opportunity for a strong Baltimore to say, oh, you know, we can recruit you up here and put an arena for you and build that city that you're talking about with real estate, that we could build that in a different part of Baltimore to host a basketball and football team, but it's or a hockey team, but there's no palette here. I'm trying to figure out the palette for expensive baseball and expensive football. Because as I told Leonard Raskin, baseball was built here on my father working at the point and he taking his 10-year-old boy in the summer of 79 to baseball games for a lifetime of love of baseball, where a couple of bucks got you in and you had an experience. That baseball was always that sport. Hockey was never that, right? But baseball was always that sport that you could afford to
Yeah, it was
do often.
accessible. Yeah.
And you're finding in Oakland, there's, you know, you want to keep players,
Yeah.
you know, I mean, we want to keep this group of young players, paying them and being the kind of franchise that can have $160, $180 million current payroll. I don't know
Right.
if Baltimore's that market. We're going to
Right.
find out. I mean, the biggest thing in baseball moving forward is how they're going to fund it all,
Right.
because they're not going to get it off the side of the cable television, your grandmother who puts
Right.
money in doesn't watch the games, right?
Right. The whole regional network thing that's going away. And so, yeah, how that's going to work.
Gonna be like being an author, being a media. We're gonna have to like actually sell stuff to make our money. You have to sell books when you're an author, right?
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
Well, I hope you sell a billion of them, dude. And you took on a
Thanks,
topic
man.
that I've been. It's been fun for me to catch up with you and talk to you about it, even though I called you about the Oakland A's or about
Yeah,
Wax Pack and all that stuff. But I appreciate you. Keep up the good work. And next time, I swear I'm gonna do a half an hour on the Bugs at Tahiti because every time you bring it
that's
up.
right. That's right.
Every time you bring it up,
Well,
I think of the dolphins of Tahiti and I think of the views in Tahiti and the rainbows in Tahiti. And while I'm doing all that as a tourist, you're studying the bugs.
that's right. Next time we'll have to get to
Let's do that over some Poisson Cru proper. I
that.
think
All
we should do
right.
that.
Yeah.
And some Hinano. He is Brad Balouchin. I am Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking wrestling and the Iron Sheik. And interesting authors with interesting stories and wise conversations.